This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Quarterback, Inside the Most Important Position in the National Football League. This is the author, John Feinstein. Dedication. This is for three men who helped make a Civil War possible 22 years ago and have remained close friends ever since. Bob Sutton, Tim Kelly, Dick Hall. I cherish their friendship. Introduction. On the afternoon of October 1, 2017, the Pittsburgh Steelers and Baltimore Ravens met in Baltimore in what was billed by the media as a battle for first place in the National Football League's AFC North Division. Both teams were 2-1, but the Ravens' record was deceiving. They had opened the season by beating the decidedly mediocre Cincinnati Bengals and then had beaten the historically bad Cleveland Browns in week two before traveling to London to get pounded 44-7 by a surprisingly good Jacksonville team. The Steelers had also beaten the Browns and had then beaten the Minnesota Vikings before losing stunningly to the Chicago Bears on the road. In short, people were still trying to figure out how good the two teams were, and this game would certainly provide some clues. The Ravens had not had a good offseason. Their most reliable receiver, Dennis Pitta, had suffered a career-ending hip injury during one of their mini-camps, or as they're now called in NFL vernacular, OTAs, Organized Team Activities. The team's 2015 first-round draft pick, wide receiver Breshad Perriman, had blazing speed. His 4.29 40-yard dash had wowed Baltimore's scouts. He had just one weakness, an inability to actually catch a football on a regular basis, a glaring issue given that his job was to catch footballs. Both starting guards, including Pro Bowler Marshall Yanda, were out for the season. There was no consistent running back unless you counted Alex Collins, a talented rookie with a penchant for fumbling. Danny Woodhead, an excellent third-down receiver acquired during the offseason, was, you guessed it, injured. Joe Flacco had been the Ravens' starting quarterback for 10 years, having been drafted in 2008 out of the University of Delaware. His arrival had ended a search for a solid quarterback that had started when the team first moved from Cleveland prior to the 1996 season. The Ravens had actually won a Super Bowl after the 2000 season with Trent Dilfer playing quarterback, largely because they had put together one of the great defenses in league history. General manager Ozzie Newsome had taken Flacco with the 18th pick in the 08 draft at the urging of scouting director Eric DaCosta, who had gone to see Delaware play at Navy the previous October and had left the game at halftime with stars in his eyes. "I was supposed to go to a game at Maryland, 28 miles away from Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium, later that afternoon," he said. "I was so excited about Flacco, I went back to the office and began digging out any tape of him I could find." Flacco was 6'6", weighed 240 pounds, and had a cannon for an arm. He looked effortless throwing the ball downfield, and even though Navy's defense that year wasn't very good, DaCosta watched in awe as Flacco made difficult throws look easy. 10 years later, Flacco had won a Super Bowl and had been for a while the highest-paid player in the NFL. Even though other quarterbacks had surpassed him in total dollars, Flacco was still doing just fine. He was in the second year of a 6-year contract worth $120.6 million. At 32, he was without question the face of the Ravens franchise. Which meant, as with almost every starting quarterback in the NFL, he often went from toast of the town to roasted by the town from week to week. Most of the criticism rolled off Flacco's broad back. He had acquired the nickname of Cool Joe early on because his demeanor almost always stayed the same. If you were going strictly off facial expressions or body language, it was difficult to tell if Flacco had just thrown a touchdown pass or an interception. "The criticism comes with the territory," he said with a smile. "If you're going to accept being put on a pedestal when you play well, you better be ready to accept getting chopped down when you don't play well." "Even when it's not your fault?" I asked one day. "It's always my fault," he said. On that warm October afternoon on their home turf against the Steelers, it was Flacco's fault, even if he had plenty of help. The Ravens were bad. They trailed 19-0 at halftime and lost 26-9 in a game that really wasn't that close. Flacco threw two fourth-quarter interceptions, one a deflection, and Collins had a critical first-half fumble. The defense, which had caused 10 turnovers in the first two games, couldn't get Ben Roethlisberger and the Steelers off the field. In all, it was a long day for all the Ravens. It began with the team kneeling as one prior to the playing of the national anthem. This was a week after Donald Trump's rant about players not standing for the anthem, and the Ravens had decided to take a knee together before the anthem. Even though the song hadn't begun yet and the entire team was standing when the music started, many fans booed the gesture. The boos would have been quickly forgotten had the team played better, but it didn't, and the boos were heard frequently during the second half, except for a brief period when the Ravens rallied to close the deficit to 19-9. After the game ended with the stands half empty and the Steelers walking away with a 26-9 victory, Flacco was brought into the interview room by the Ravens public relations staff. Every NFL quarterback comes into the interview room postgame. Most wait as long as possible before going in. They chat with teammates, shower, dress, and as their final act before leaving the stadium to meet their families, come in to talk to the media. They can take as long as they want to, because there are two people the media must listen to after a game, the head coach and the quarterback. The coach usually goes in as soon as the locker room is open to the media. The quarterback almost always goes last, often 45 minutes to an hour after the game has ended. Not Flacco. If Ravens coach John Harbaugh doesn't go in quickly, Flacco is apt to be the first one in, still in uniform except for his helmet. "You have to do it. You might as well get it over with," he said with a smile. "I don't mind it. I usually know what the questions are going to be. So I go in, get it done, and then get ready to go home." Flacco has five kids, so when the team plays at home, he doesn't linger in the locker room the way some players do. On rare occasions, to give him a break from the interview room questions, Kevin Byrne, who has run public relations for the Ravens since 1986 when they were still in Cleveland, will tell Flacco not to come to the interview room. When that happens, he stands in front of his locker and answers the same questions he would have gotten in the interview room. Following the Steelers' loss, Flacco came in right after Harbaugh. After he had answered a general question about the game, someone said, "Joe, how would you assess your play today?" Flacco smiled for a moment, shrugged, and said, "I sucked. We sucked as an offense, and I'm the quarterback, so I'm responsible. It's pretty simple." The real answer to the question would have been something like this: "Look, my most reliable receiver went down in June. I threw a perfect deep ball early to Mike Wallace, and he dropped it. Our first-round draft pick from 2015 couldn't catch a cold, much less a football. Our offensive line is a mess, and we've got no running game. There's only so much I can do." Of course, there was no way Flacco was going to say any of that. "You never throw your teammates under the bus," he said. "Anything you say that's critical of anyone but yourself is going to look like you're making excuses, and to some degree, it is making excuses. If I whined that way, fans wouldn't buy it, but more important than that, I couldn't go home and look my father in the eye. You take the credit when it's all good. You take the blame when it's bad. And when you're the quarterback, the blame ultimately should always fall on you." Not long after Flacco had finished talking to the media, I got in my car to drive home. I turned on the Ravens postgame show on WBAL radio. Keith Mills, the host, was just starting to take phone calls. The first caller was wound up and upset. "Keith," he said, "when is Joe Flacco going to stand up and take responsibility for the failures of this offense?" Mills didn't really know what to say. Politely, on air, he said, "I thought he did." Later, off air, he said, "Beyond saying I sucked, what else was he supposed to say?" Exactly right. The caller represents the heart and soul of what this book is about. There is no position in sports that is more glamorous, more lucrative, more visible, more high risk than being a starting NFL quarterback. In 32 cities, the quarterback carries the hopes and dreams of millions of fans, and is the centerpiece for the media that covers every NFL team. The NFL, even with all the issues that have beset it in recent years, remains the colossus of professional sports in the United States. It dominates the sports media 12 months a year. An off day by a starting quarterback during off-season workouts in May can cause all-out panic among those covering a team. Billion-dollar franchises may rise or fall on the shoulders of one 20-something athlete. Aaron Rodgers is carted off a football field in Minnesota, and the entire state of Wisconsin goes into mourning. The most controversial and talked-about figure in Washington, D.C. in 2017 might have been Donald Trump, but Kirk Cousins wasn't far behind. Quarterback is a dependent position. Linemen must block, receivers must run precise patterns and make catches while being crushed by defenders. But if it all goes right, the quarterback becomes the most popular man in that city. If it goes wrong, no matter how razor-thin the margin, and even if he's standing on the sideline when the decisive plays are being made, he becomes the fall guy. The line between being rich, famous, and beloved, or rich, famous, and excoriated, is almost invisible at times. Quarterbacks make the most money, they receive the most endorsements, and they are the subject of the most publicity. They know that 8 months of preparing to play 16 games can go down the drain in a heartbeat, and ultimately the finger will be pointed at them. Doug Williams, the first African-American quarterback to start and win a Super Bowl, talks about seeing colors. The reference is to a quarterback who feels the pressure of huge men bearing down on him and releases the ball or sprints from the pocket a split second too soon rather than hanging in there, knowing a painful hit is coming and making the play. The great ones don't see colors. It's easier said than done. No one is ever neutral on a quarterback's performance, including the quarterback. Flacco's case is a prime example. He signed a new contract shortly after leading the Ravens to a victory in the 2013 Super Bowl. He had turned down a long-term offer from the Ravens the previous spring because he believed if he had a good year, he would be paid a lot more than what the team was offering. He was praised for betting on himself when the bet paid off, and he signed for 6 years at about $20 million a year. He never saw it quite that way. Unless I got seriously hurt, someone was going to pay me good money at the end of my contract, he said. I was going to be 28, presumably going into the prime years of my career. I knew if I produced, Ravens owner Steve Bisciotti would pay me fairly, because he's that kind of guy. And if he didn't, someone else would. I didn't see it as that much of a gamble. Quarterbacks are almost always the highest paid players on their teams. They are also the most visible because they touch the ball on every offensive play. They get credit for touchdown passes, even if they toss the ball 5 yards to someone who then runs 90 yards through the defense, and blame for interceptions, even if they throw a perfect pass and it bounces off their receiver's hands. Most are like Flacco. They get it. They know that the fans and media will rip them for the failures of their teammates and canonize them for the success of the team. Or, as in the case of the Kansas City Chiefs' Alex Smith in 2017, they know they can go from being an MVP candidate to hearing media members ask the coach if he's thinking about benching him in 6 weeks. The best quarterbacks understand that the mood of an entire city is often on their shoulders. When Aaron Rodgers broke his collarbone in the 6th week of the 2017 season, virtually everyone in Wisconsin woke up the next day in a bad mood. You almost expected the Green Bay Packers to show up the next Sunday wearing black patches on their uniforms that said Aaron, as if he had died. Fortunately, Rodgers was very much alive, just hurt. It was the Packers' season that had died. They were 4-1 when Rodgers went down. They went 3-8 the rest of the way, Rodgers coming back for one late-season game. Clearly rusty and looking nowhere close to healthy, he threw 3 interceptions and 3 touchdown passes in a 31-24 loss to a good Carolina Panthers team. Rodgers was not, by any stretch, the only quarterback who suffered a major injury that destroyed his team's season. Andrew Luck missed the entire season in Indianapolis. Predictably, the Colts finished 4-12. Luck landed in Indianapolis in 2012, after being the number one pick in the NFL draft coming out of Stanford. The Colts were in the number one spot because Peyton Manning had missed all of the 2011 season after neck surgery. As the Colts' losses piled up that fall, many Indianapolis fans began to root for their team to keep losing so it could draft Luck. The slogan, "Suck for Luck," was born. The Colts finished 2-14. Luck was a golden child most of his life. He was the son of a former NFL quarterback who went on to become athletic director at West Virginia, his alma mater, and was then hired by the NCAA. After retiring, Oliver Luck was the general manager of two teams in the World League of American Football, one in London and the other in Frankfurt. As a result, Andrew grew up at least as much a soccer fan as a football fan. But he had his father's gift for the game and was a bigger 6'4", 240-pound, more athletic version of his dad, who was listed at 6'2", 196 pounds. He chose Stanford because it was a great place to go to school and because he would be playing for Jim Harbaugh, also a former NFL quarterback. By the time he was a redshirt junior, it was almost a given that Luck would be the number one pick in the NFL draft. He almost certainly would have been the number one pick a year earlier, but he chose to return to Stanford because he liked college and wanted to graduate. A year later, after Luck led Stanford to an 11-2 record and finished second in the Heisman Trophy voting behind Baylor's Robert Griffin III, the Colts took him with the number one pick. Washington took Griffin after giving up a bevy of draft picks to get up to number two. Both starred as rookies, leading their teams to the playoffs. The Colts went from 2-14 in the YAP, year after Peyton, to 11-5 in the first year AAA, after Andrew arrived. Both teams lost in the opening round of the playoffs. Washington lost at home to Seattle in a game that changed Griffin's life and the arc of the franchise. Griffin tore up his knee, was kept on the field by Coach Mike Shanahan after he'd gotten hurt in the first quarter, and was never the same player after that afternoon. That same day, Luck played well while the Colts were losing on the road to the Baltimore Ravens, who would go on to win the Super Bowl. Luck's star continued to glow brighter the next two seasons. The Colts were 11-5 again in both seasons, winning one playoff game in 2013 and two in 2014 before losing, badly, to the Patriots in the AFC Championship in the infamous Deflategate game. It was during his fourth season, 2015, that injuries began to become an issue for Luck. He missed two early season games after feeling pain in his throwing shoulder. He came back and played the next 5 weeks before a lacerated kidney and a torn abdominal muscle forced him out for the rest of the season. Frustrating as it was, Luck knew, as every football player knows, that injuries are almost inevitable if you have a lengthy career. Even Tom Brady, who seems invincible, missed an entire season after tearing an ACL in week one of the 2008 season. The Colts certainly weren't worried about the long-term future of their franchise quarterback. On June 29, 2016, a few weeks prior to the start of his fifth training camp, Luck signed a six-year, $140 million contract with the Colts with $87 million guaranteed. That made him the highest-paid player in the history of the NFL. "Didn't make me the best player in the history of the NFL," he said one night with a smile. "It just meant I was next in line." In fact, Derek Carr, Matthew Stafford, Jimmy Garoppolo, Kirk Cousins, and Aaron Rodgers have since surpassed Luck's contract in annual value, with Drew Brees likely to go past them in the near future. But the upward arc of Luck's career came to a halt in 2016. The shoulder pain that had kept him out of two games the previous season never completely went away, even after he sat out the last 6 weeks because of the kidney problem. It didn't hurt enough to keep him out of the lineup, but it wasn't getting better. Making deep throws became more difficult. Then pushing his way through a revolving door or shaking hands or reaching for a spoon began to hurt. He had hoped to avoid surgery, but in January 2017, after the Colts had gone 8-8 for a second straight season, he decided it was time to get the injury behind him once and for all and had labrum surgery. He wasn't worried about being ready for OTAs. Most veterans need OTAs like a hockey player needs time to practice his skating, but he planned to be ready to go at 100% when training camp began in July. only it didn't happen. In fact, Luck never took a snap all season. He returned to light practice briefly in October, then flew to the Netherlands in late October to seek treatment. Without Luck, the Colts season was destroyed. They went 4-12. It isn't as if a team can't survive an injury to the starting quarterback. Carson Wentz was on his way to winning the MVP award when he tore his ACL in week 14 of the Philadelphia Eagles 2017 season. Nick Foles, who had been a starter previously in the NFL, stepped in and took the Eagles to a Super Bowl championship. It was a wonderful story, but it's worth remembering that the Eagles had already clinched their division when Wentz got hurt, and they got to play both their NFL playoff games at home. If Wentz had been hurt in, say, week 7, it might have been a different story. There was also Case Keenum, who stepped in for Sam Bradford and took the Minnesota Vikings to the NFC Championship game that same season. Another feel-good story. Except Bradford isn't exactly Luck, or Brady, or Drew Brees, or Aaron Rodgers. The drop-off at quarterback wasn't that great. Rodgers, ironically, was hurt in a game against the Vikings in Week 6. The Packers were 4-1 when he was carted off with a broken collarbone. By the time he returned, the Packers were 7-6, having barely beaten the winless Browns to avoid being 6-7. They went from Super Bowl contenders to, ultimately, out of the playoffs. If you lose a good quarterback, you might be able to survive, usually short-term. Lose a great one, and almost always your season is done, unless your backup is Tom Brady, who stepped in when Drew Bledsoe was injured the second week of the 2000 season and went on to become, well, Tom Brady. Perhaps Jimmy Garoppolo, who took over for Brady during his Deflategate suspension and is now in San Francisco, will be the closest thing we've seen to Brady since then. Playing quarterback isn't like playing any other position in professional sports. The quarterback runs every one of his team's offensive plays. He is the glamour guy, the rich guy, the face of the franchise, and when things go wrong, the guy who takes the fall. And quarterbacks take a physical beating. There's a difference between being injured and being hurt, Alex Smith, who played his 13th NFL season a year ago, said. Most games, you come into the locker room, take off your uniform, and sort of check around to make sure nothing hurts too badly. Something always hurts. It's just a matter of how much. The quarterback, along with the head coach, is also the team spokesman. He is expected to speak to the media after every game, more often than not in the interview room with all the cameras clicking and whirring. What I set out to do in this book is to try to get inside the head of a number of quarterbacks who have played in the NFL for a while, who have experienced the best and worst of playing the position, who have dealt with injuries and fans and the media ready to point a finger at them first and foremost when their team doesn't win the Super Bowl. I didn't go looking for the 5 or 6 best quarterbacks in the NFL. I went looking for a cross-section of smart quarterbacks, knowing full well that only the smartest guys would understand what I was hoping to accomplish in writing this book largely through their eyes. I ended up with what I think was an eclectic list of 5 very bright, very accomplished, and very patient men. Alex Smith, Andrew Luck, Joe Flacco, Ryan Fitzpatrick, and Doug Williams. Williams is different from the other 4 in that he's retired and he's African American. I needed an African American voice in the book because the experience, even now, is very different than it is for white quarterbacks. Williams was the first African American quarterback to win a Super Bowl, and can vividly remember when the mere notion of a black quarterback in the NFL was worthy of headlines. Plus, he's willing to speak his mind. Williams is now director of player personnel in Washington. When I asked him where Deshaun Watson, the superb Houston rookie whose season was ended by an ACL injury, would have gone in the 2017 draft had he been white, he smiled and said, before Mitchell Trubisky. Trubisky went number 2, I said. Watson had been picked 12th. I know, Williams said. There is great hope in Houston right now because of what Texans fans have seen of Watson. In Chicago, there's hope too, but questions still about Trubisky even after his outstanding start in 2018. That's pretty much the way it is in the NFL. If you think you've got your franchise quarterback, the feeling is that everything else will fall into place. If not, well, you're the Cleveland Browns. At least pre-Baker Mayfield. Part 1. 1. As he trotted back onto the field at Arrowhead Stadium on the evening of January 6, 2018, Alex Smith knew exactly what was at stake at that moment. Having led 21-3 at halftime, the Kansas City Chiefs now trailed the Tennessee Titans 22-21 with 2:18 left to play in the AFC wildcard game. A little more than 3 hours earlier, when the game kicked off just after 3:30 Central Time, the temperature had been 30 degrees, though it felt colder because of the swirling winds whipping through the stadium. Now, with the sun down, it was considerably colder. The last thing on Smith's mind was the weather. Once you get into a game, you stop thinking about whether it's hot or cold or windy or rainy, he said. If there's a lot of wind, or if the ball's wet, you have to think about that because that affects the way you play. But you really don't feel the cold, especially at that point in the season. You're way beyond that. What's happening on the field is way too important. What was happening as Smith stepped into the huddle was pretty simple. The Chiefs' entire season was at stake. All the off-season work, the springtime OTAs, training camp in the brutal Midwestern summer heat, and 16 enervating regular season games essentially came down to one play. There was a chance we might get the ball back, Smith said, but even if we did, it would have taken something miraculous to save us by then. This was our best chance. That's why we knew we had to go for it. Their chance came with the ball on the Tennessee 44-yard line. The Chiefs had driven the ball to that point from their own 27 after the Titans had scored to go ahead with 6:06 left in the game. Plenty of time. Except the Chiefs hadn't scored in the second half, while the Titans had found the end zone on all three of their possessions. The Chiefs had one last chance to save their season. Smith, one of the National Football League's more nimble quarterbacks even at age 33, had picked up 18 yards to the Tennessee 42 on the second play of the drive, only to have the play called back by a holding penalty on tight end Demetrius Harris. The hold wasn't the most egregious call, or non-call, made that evening by referee Jeff Triplett and his crew, but it was questionable. Harris made up for his mistake by catching a 3rd-and-4 pass from Smith to set the Chiefs up at the Tennessee 45 with a first down. One more first down, and they would probably be in field goal kicker Harrison Butker's range. But the offense had bogged down there. Kareem Hunt, the NFL's leading rusher as a rookie, picked up a yard on first down. A short Smith to Harris pass was broken up. Then, with nobody open, Smith had been forced to scramble and had barely made it back to the line of scrimmage. Suddenly, it was 4th and 9. The 2-minute warning was approaching, and the Chiefs had to take their second timeout. Smith came to the sideline and consulted with head coach Andy Reid and offensive coordinator Matt Nagy. 6 weeks earlier, in the midst of a skid during which the Chiefs had lost 6 of 7 games, Reid had handed the play-calling duties to Nagy. Sometimes when things go wrong, you have to look at yourself, Reid had said in announcing the change. For Smith, the only real change had been logistical. Nagy had been at Reed's side for 4 years and thought very much the way Reed did. He had also been the voice Smith heard inside his helmet when plays were relayed in. The only real difference was that Matt didn't have to relay Andy's calls, he said. That probably saved 5 to 10 seconds on each snap. Gave me more time if I wanted to check off, change the play, at the line or if I wanted to change a protection. When you see a quarterback step to the line and point at someone on the defensive side, it's usually to let his offensive line know that someone is in a different spot than expected. That can mean that who blocks whom is being changed. Reid and Nagy were in agreement that the best play call was, quote, 22-on-3 set, scat, red, right, personnel. In English, that reflected Smith's receiving options, the line protections, and the personnel on the field. He could also audible. That meant Albert Wilson, a 4th-year wide receiver, would be the primary target running down the middle of the field. If Travis Kelce had been in the game, he would have been the primary receiver. Kelce was the Chiefs' leading receiver, Smith's go-to guy on big plays. He'd caught 83 balls in the regular season and had made his 4th catch of the game late in the first half on a short crossing route. Kelce was hit as soon as he caught the ball by the Titans' Zach Brown. As Kelce was going down, Tennessee safety Jonathan Cyprian dove at him and hit him helmet to helmet. For all its talk about player safety, the NFL still hasn't figured it out. According to the league's apologists, Cyprian's hit did not merit a penalty because Kelce was, quote, a runner, as opposed to being, quote, helpless, trying to make a catch. Kelce was on his way down because of Brown's tackle and pretty helpless. Finally, for the 2018 season, the NFL did tighten the rule. Whether Cyprian intended to hurt him or not didn't matter. He did. When Kelce attempted to stand up, it was clear he had been knocked silly, and he fell into the arms of teammates. Watching Kelce being led off the field, Smith knew he was done for the night. "You could see it in his eyes," he said later. "At that moment, I don't think he knew where he was." The lack of a flag and the absence of Kelce didn't matter for the next few minutes. Kelce's catch had set up a 3rd and 6 at the Chiefs' 25. 7 plays later, Smith threw a perfect 14-yard scoring strike to DeMarcus Robinson with 3 seconds left in the half, and Kansas City's halftime lead was 21-3. Thoughts of a trip to New England, back to the place where the season had started, danced through the minds of most in the sold-out stands at Arrowhead Stadium. Except the lead didn't last. The Titans scored touchdowns on their first 3 second-half series, the first coming when quarterback Marcus Mariota tried to throw a pass into the end zone on 3rd and goal from the 6-yard line, only to have it knocked away by nickelback Darrell Revis. The ball ricocheted right back to Mariota, who caught it and dove into the end zone. It was the first time in NFL playoff history that a quarterback threw and caught a touchdown pass on the same play. Mariota to Mariota was a key play, since it closed the gap to 21-10 after a drive that lasted 8 minutes. But it also turned out to be a harbinger. The Chiefs had one great chance to perhaps put the game away when they recovered a fumbled punt at the Tennessee 30-yard line. But the offense wasn't the same without Kelce and didn't move the ball. Butker, who had been remarkably reliable all season, came in for a 48-yard field goal attempt, but the ball clanged off the right upright. And so, Mariota's 22-yard touchdown pass to Eric Decker, with 6:06 left, had put the Titans in the lead, 22-21. On the ensuing 2-point conversion attempt, Chiefs safety Daniel Sorensen blitzed, spun Mariota around, and appeared to force a fumble, which he picked up and took the other way for what would have been a 2-point play for the Chiefs, giving them the lead back. But referee Jeff Triplett, working his last NFL game, decided that Mariota's forward progress had been stopped and ruled him down. That left the Chiefs trailing. Which is why the game and Smith's 5 seasons in Kansas City suddenly came down to 1 play. That wasn't on Smith's mind as he came to the line and waited for the snap. Looking at the Tennessee defense, he thought the coaches had made the correct call, so he didn't audible. The shotgun snap from center Zach Fulton was true, and Smith took a couple of quick steps back, saw that Wilson had come open for a moment, and zinged the ball down the middle in his direction. But the Titans had safety help coming from deep, and Wilson was hit as he reached for the ball. It slipped off his fingers and bounced away harmlessly. The game wasn't over. The Chiefs had all 3 timeouts and the 2-minute warning still left. But Titans running back Derrick Henry ran the ball once for 12 yards and then for 22 yards. The second first down eliminated any doubt. Mariota knelt twice, and Kansas City's season, which had started with so much promise, was over. The Chiefs trudged silently into their locker room. There really wasn't much to say. "You can talk about it all you want," Smith said. "You can talk about the missed calls, and they were huge, no doubt. You can talk about Kelce, getting hurt and what that meant. You can second-guess yourself. That's sort of natural. In the end, none of it matters. Your first goal every season is to get to postseason. Once you do that, anything can happen. You can win on the road. You can lose at home. You can be the 6th seed and win the Super Bowl. It happens. But there are no second chances once you get to January. We had our chance. We had the big lead at halftime. Bottom line is always the bottom line, the final score. We just didn't get it done." Statistically, Smith had just completed his best season in the NFL. He had led his team to a second straight AFC Western Division title, the first time in the Chiefs' 58-year history that had happened. He had thrown for more than 4,000 yards in spite of sitting out the regular season finale after the Chiefs had clinched the division title a week earlier. And yet, almost from the instant Smith's last pass fell incomplete, the biggest question in Kansas City was who would be under center when the 2018 season started the following September. "Nothing is forever," Smith said, "especially in football, especially when you're a quarterback." Ryan Fitzpatrick had been in the NFL for the same 13 seasons as Smith. His career arc, however, could not have been more different. Several years earlier, Smith and Fitzpatrick had both played in the annual celebrity golf tournament held each July, shortly before the start of training camp, in Lake Tahoe. As luck would have it, the two were paired together on the first day. The introductions in Tahoe tend to be fairly lavish, if only to remind the crowd just how important each celebrity golfer is in his own world. And so it wasn't surprising that when Smith stepped up onto the tee, the starter grandly announced, "Please welcome the number one pick in the 2005 NFL draft from the Kansas City Chiefs, Alex Smith." A moment later, it was Fitzpatrick's turn to be introduced. He had asked that the starter not mention his Harvard education, whom he was playing for, or any success he'd had in his career. Instead, the starter, following Fitzpatrick's request, had said, "Please welcome the 250th pick in the 2005 NFL draft, Ryan Fitzpatrick." Smith had been drafted ahead of the other 255 players chosen in that draft. Fitzpatrick had been drafted ahead of the last six. "And happy to be chosen there," he said with a laugh. In a twist, Smith and Fitzpatrick had almost been teammates in college. Both were excellent students in high school. Fitzpatrick growing up near Phoenix, Smith in San Diego. Neither was recruited very much, if at all, by the so-called big-time schools. Fitzpatrick, after being ardently pursued by Coach Tim Murphy, decided to go to Harvard. "I was figuring I'd get a chance to start, play on a good team," Harvard was always at or near the top of the Ivy League, "and I'd leave with a Harvard degree. Anything in football after that would just be gravy. I certainly wasn't counting on it." Smith felt much the same way. "When I dreamed about football as a kid, it was about college football," he said. "It was about being in a packed stadium on a Saturday and getting to play in a bowl game when the season was over. The thought of the NFL never crossed my mind. It was always about college football for me." Even though Smith's Helix High School won a state championship in Smith's senior year, most of the credit went to his teammate Reggie Bush, who would go on to win the Heisman Trophy at USC in 2005. Helix also produced NBA star Bill Walton. Smith was rated as a two-star prospect by the various scouting services, meaning he was considered a marginal Division I prospect. Smith's uncle, John L. Smith, was the head coach at Louisville in the fall of 2001 when Smith was a senior at Helix. Louisville recruited him, but Smith thought there might be some nepotism involved and wasn't sure he wanted to go someplace where people would think he got his scholarship only because his uncle was the coach. Utah had also shown some interest, and Smith was familiar with the Salt Lake City area, largely because he and his family often skied in Utah, so he was intrigued. And then there was Harvard. "I was interested in the Ivy League in general. We made a trip east the summer before my senior year and visited Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Penn. I liked them all, but I really liked Coach Murphy and, well, Harvard was Harvard. My mom was completely sold on Harvard. I honestly think I would have ended up there if not for the postseason thing. It wasn't as if Utah was telling me they were dying to have me. In fact, the thought was that I'd redshirt as a freshman, which was fine. But I had always thought of college football as ending with your team playing in a bowl game, any bowl game. I wanted that to be part of my college experience. The Ivy League doesn't let its champion play postseason. I had trouble understanding that, and it really was kind of a downer for me when making my decision." For some reason that can only be explained, no doubt, by those smart enough to be Ivy League presidents, the conference allows teams from every other sport, including basketball, to take part in postseason play. Two Ivy League teams have made basketball's Final Four: Bill Bradley's famous Princeton team in 1965 and Pennsylvania in 1979. In recent years, both Harvard and Yale have pulled first-round upsets that brought the schools and the league a good deal of attention, not to mention revenue. In 2010, Cornell reached the Sweet 16. Smith finally chose Utah, a solid Division I program that had gone to a bowl game in 2001. He knew he would be asked to redshirt, not play as a freshman, in order to gain eligibility for a fifth fall at Utah, which was not a problem with him, even though he would be entering college as a junior since he had received 9 AP credits in high school. Had he chosen to go to Harvard, Smith would not have redshirted. The Ivy League doesn't allow it, but wouldn't have started there as a freshman since the Crimson returned Neil Rose, who was a senior, and Fitzpatrick, a sophomore, at quarterback. "Ryan was perfect for us to come in and back Neil up and then take over," Harvard coach Tim Murphy said. "He was an excellent student, so we knew he could get into school, and I knew he'd learn fast, so he'd be ready to play when Neil graduated. As it turned out, he was ready to play before Neil was done. We had to find ways to get him on the field." Like Smith, Fitzpatrick harbored no thoughts about an NFL career. He was an economics major at Harvard and almost certainly would have gone to grad school if he hadn't been given the chance to play football after graduation. In his senior season, Fitzpatrick led Harvard to a 10-0 record and began to get attention from NFL scouts. In those days, the draft was held over 2 days, as opposed to now when it drags out over 3. And Fitzpatrick knew he wasn't going to be taken during the first 3 rounds on day 1. By the time the 7th and final round started the next day, he had resigned himself to the possibility that he wouldn't be drafted at all. Minutes before the draft ended, the St. Louis Rams took him with pick number 250. Fitzpatrick was delighted. "I wanted to be drafted," he said. "Teams will always give someone they drafted a shot as opposed to someone they sign as a free agent. I knew I'd have a shot to make the team." He made the Rams and started 3 games after coming off the bench in week 11 to lead them to a 33-27 overtime win over the Titans in a game his team had trailed 24-3 at halftime. When he started a week later, he became the first Harvard graduate to start an NFL game at quarterback. 2 years later, his odyssey began. He was traded to Cincinnati, where he stayed for 2 seasons, before moving to Buffalo to play for the Bills for 4 seasons, to Tennessee to play 1 year for the Titans, to Houston, and then to the Jets for 2 seasons. He started for most of 2 seasons in Buffalo and often spelled starters in Cincinnati, Tennessee, and Houston. In his first season in New York, he had a career year, starting all season and leading the Jets to a 10-6 record, missing the playoffs on the final Sunday by losing to his former team, the Bills, and the Jets' former coach, Rex Ryan. "That one hurt," he said. "Our fate was completely in our hands, and we let it get away. I felt responsible." The quarterback is always responsible. A year later, he lost his starting job, then got it back during a miserable 5-11 season. New York fans have short memories, and Fitzpatrick was booed as the season unraveled. Getting his job back and a win in the season finale was small consolation. "I honestly thought my career might be over," he said. "I thought maybe it should be over. It was time. I'd played 12 years, a lot longer than I ever expected to play. I'd made a lot more money than I ever expected to make and had a lot more success than I think people ever thought I would have. I remember when I went past 25,000 yards. In career passing yardage. My dad was so proud. So if it was over, I was okay with it, although it certainly wasn't the exit I'd hoped for." Then came May, and an offer to go to Tampa Bay to back up and mentor Jameis Winston. The Bucs appeared to be on the verge of a breakthrough, and there was no doubt that Winston, the oft-controversial 2013 Heisman Trophy winner from Florida State, was the centerpiece of the renaissance. Even though it meant moving his family, 6 children, the oldest 11, yet again, Fitzpatrick decided to go back for one more year. The money wasn't close to what he had made in New York, $12 million in 2016, but $3 million to back up Winston was a pretty fair deal. So, as the old song from the Beverly Hillbillies went, he and his wife Liza loaded up the truck and moved to Tampa. Bay, that is, swimming pools, a rising football team. In the meantime, Andrew Luck was contemplating his comeback in Indianapolis. He'd finally had the shoulder surgery he'd wanted to avoid in January and expected to be back in plenty of time to get ready for the 2017 season. Little did he know that he would never see the field. Joe Flacco was also on the mend, slowly recovering from an injury he suffered lifting weights during the offseason. In an ideal world, he would have played in one preseason game, but as it turned out, everyone, including Flacco, decided not to take any risks in a game that ultimately didn't count. Unlike Luck, though, he was on the practice field and knew he'd be ready to go for the opener in Cincinnati. As for Doug Williams, he hadn't taken an NFL snap since 1989, when he had retired at the age of 34 after losing his job as Washington's starter to Mark Rypien. Less than 2 years earlier, Williams had become the first African-American to start in the Super Bowl at quarterback. He had thrown for 340 yards in the game and had thrown four touchdown passes in the second quarter, leading Washington from a 10-0 first quarter deficit to a 35-10 halftime lead on the Denver Broncos. The final was 42-10. Williams had been a coach and a scout after retiring, and finally, in the spring of 2017, had been named Washington's director of player personnel. Much like Ozzie Newsome in Baltimore in 1996, he wasn't given the title of general manager, even though he had the responsibilities of one. His attitude was much the same as Newsome's had been. "When I prove to them that I can do the job, they'll give me the title," he said. "I don't need the title. I want the job. I want the chance to prove myself." He smiled. "That's all I've ever asked my entire life." 2. Doug Williams never wanted to be a football player. His first loves growing up in Zachary, Louisiana, were baseball and basketball. "I thought I was the second coming of Pete Maravich or Don Drysdale or both," he said, laughing in his deep baritone at the memory. "I had no desire to play football. I didn't want to get hit. I didn't want any part of contact." When he got to the eighth grade, he was informed that he didn't have a choice anymore about football. The informer was Robert, his oldest brother. Doug was the sixth of Robert and Laura Williams's eight children. Robert, the oldest, was 15 years older than Doug. He had played football and baseball at Grambling and had gone to training camp with the Cleveland Indians in 1964. But he tore his rotator cuff that spring. In those days, the injury was career-ending. Robert Williams came home to Zachary to coach basketball at Cheneyville High School, assist with the football team, and coach the junior high football team. His little brother was going to play football. "Actually, he gave me a choice," Doug said. "He said I could play football or fight him, and if I won the fight, I didn't have to play. So I played. No sense wasting time getting beaten up." Doug Williams was 5'4" and weighed, quote, "about nothing" as an eighth grader. A year later, he was 5'6" and still weighed close to nothing when he enrolled at Cheneyville, the all-black high school in still-segregated Zachary. Back then, the town, which is about 15 miles north of Baton Rouge, had a population of just over 5,000. It has grown since then to a population of just under 15,000 in the 2010 census. Cheneyville's coach was Bernard Lucas, a no-nonsense former player at Southern. Doug told him that he was a quarterback, even though, quote, "I could barely see over the line when I lined up to take a snap." Since he wasn't going to see much time behind more experienced and bigger quarterbacks, Lucas played Williams at safety. That didn't last very long. Early in the season, Cheneyville faced Second Ward High School. The Ward quarterback was a talented freshman named Terry Robiski, who would go on to become one of the first African-American players at LSU and then play 5 years in the NFL. "We were both ninth graders," Williams remembered. "I hadn't grown yet. Terry was already the same size he was when he went to LSU, 6'1", 210 pounds, according to his bio. "Terry ran a play right at me. I tried to go low to tackle him, and he just ran right over me. I went over to Coach Lucas and said, 'Do whatever you want to me, but I'm not playing defense anymore.'" When Robiski got to LSU in 1973, he was converted to running back. That's what coaches did with black quarterbacks in those days. Williams continued to play baseball and basketball in high school. He was all-district in basketball, but he blossomed as a football player in his junior year. By then, he'd had a major growth spurt to reach 6'2" and could throw a football a mile. Since his brother had gone to Grambling, he was recruited early by legendary coach Eddie Robinson, who coached at Grambling for 55 seasons and won a then-record 408 games. Joe Paterno surpassed him in 2011 with 409, had 111 victories stripped in 2012 in the Jerry Sandusky scandal, but then had them restored 2 years later. "I wanted to play football and baseball in college," Williams said. Coach Rob said, "I don't let my quarterbacks play baseball. They need to be in spring ball to learn." It was Eddie Robinson. If he said I wasn't playing baseball, I wasn't playing baseball. At that point in time, you did not turn down the chance to play football at Grambling. In those days, Grambling was known as the Black Notre Dame. Very few Division I schools were willing to play the Tigers. The Southeastern Conference had just started to integrate in football. Kentucky had recruited the first black football player in 1967. LSU and Mississippi in 1972 were the last teams in the league to desegregate. That same fall, Tennessee's Condridge Holloway became the SEC's first black quarterback. Holloway had also been recruited by Alabama, but had decided on Tennessee after Coach Bear Bryant told him he wouldn't be able to play quarterback because, quote, "Alabama's not ready for a black quarterback yet." "I appreciated his honesty," Holloway said in a later interview. It wasn't until 1980, when Walter Lewis was a freshman, that Bryant started a black quarterback. None of this really mattered to Williams. The only SEC school that recruited him as a high school senior in 1973 was LSU, and that was for baseball. "I played in an American Legion tournament after my senior year," he said. A coach from LSU was there, and he said they might be interested in giving me a scholarship to play baseball. I'd already committed to Coach Rob, so it was a moot point. I was going to Grambling. There were 8 quarterbacks taking snaps at preseason practice that summer, and Robinson told Williams he was going to be redshirted so he could spend the season learning the position and getting his feet on the ground academically. A year later, he was the starter and embarked on one of the most prolific college careers in history. Grambling was 39-8 during Williams' 4 seasons as a starter. In all, he threw for more than 9,000 yards running Robinson's old-fashioned wing tee offense. As a senior, he led the nation in passing with 3,286 yards and 32 touchdown passes. That fall, he finished 4th in the Heisman Trophy voting behind Earl Campbell, Terry Miller, and Ken McAfee. "I never thought about the Heisman at all," he said. "The summer before my senior year, I was playing in a softball tournament, and I got a message to call the SID, Sports Information Director, at Grambling. He said, 'We're going to push you for the Heisman this season.' I said, 'Sounds good,' and went back to playing softball." The NFL was another story. Williams wanted very much to follow in the footsteps of another great Grambling quarterback, James Harris. Like Williams, Harris, who was 6'4", had a strong arm and had quarterbacked excellent teams at Grambling. But he had graduated in 1969. At that point, only one black quarterback had ever been an NFL or AFL starter. Marlon Briscoe had been drafted in the 14th round by the AFL's Denver Broncos in 1968, coming out of Nebraska, Omaha. He had been converted to defensive back in training camp, but injuries had forced Coach Lou Saban to play him at quarterback. He started 5 games that season and played well, throwing 14 touchdown passes in his 5 starts. But Saban had decided to go with the immortal Pete Lisk as his starter for the 1969 season, and Briscoe asked for his release. He signed with Buffalo and was, naturally, converted to wide receiver. He went on to have an excellent career as a pass catcher in Buffalo, Miami, and New England. One of the quarterbacks he caught passes from was Harris, who had been taken by the Bills in the 1969 draft with a 192nd pick, which in those days was in the 8th round. The AFL and NFL were getting ready to merge in 1970 and had started holding a common draft 2 years earlier. The 10 AFL teams tended to be more willing to think outside the box than the 16 NFL teams. In those days, giving a black quarterback a chance to play was considered outside the box. Harris was a hero and role model for Williams. He was proof that you could start a quarterback in the NFL if someone was willing to give you a chance. Williams had a superb senior season leading to his fourth-place finish in the Heisman Trophy voting. There wasn't any doubt, at least in his mind, that he'd get a chance to play quarterback at the next level. But a black quarterback in the NFL was still a novelty, and for many teams considered a risk. There was no combine in those days, so it was up to teams to scout players individually when the season ended. The one team that showed a keen interest in Williams was the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, then a third-year expansion franchise that had gone 0-14 and 2-12 in its first two seasons. During that winless 1976 season, Bucs coach John McKay, a hugely successful college coach at USC, four national titles, was asked, "Coach, what do you think about your team's execution?" According to legend, McKay replied, "I'm in favor of it." McKay's running backs coach back then was 37-year-old Joe Gibbs. McKay sent Gibbs to Grambling to check Williams out. "He spent 2 days with me," Williams remembered. "He sat in on the class I was student teaching to get my degree in education. He watched me throw, and we talked for hours. I know the reason I got drafted in the first round was Joe." Gibbs would go on to become such an icon in Washington, leading the team to three Super Bowl wins, that most people there believe his first name is actually Coach, because no one would dare call him Joe. Back then, though, he was just a young assistant coach learning his trade, and he was willing to push his chips into the middle of the table to support taking a quarterback from an all-black college in the first round, which in those days was unheard of in the NFL. The Bucs took Williams with the 17th pick in the draft. He was the only quarterback taken in the first round. In fact, the second quarterback picked was Matt Cavanaugh, who went to the Patriots in the second round with the 50th pick. Even though he was a first-round pick, the Bucs offered him considerably less money than Williams and his agent Jimmy Walsh, also Joe Namath's agent, felt a quarterback taken 17th should be paid. "We held out," Williams said. "Finally, we signed a week into training camp for more than they'd offered, but less than I thought I should get. But I wanted to get going." Williams signed a 5-year contract that paid him $565,000. "I knew it was relatively low for a first-round quarterback," he said. "But at the time, I didn't care. I just wanted the chance to play." On his first day in camp, still not knowing the playbook at all, he made a mistake on a play call. Bill Nelson was the quarterback's coach, and he didn't have a lot of patience for young quarterbacks, especially one who had missed a week of camp by holding out. "I don't remember exactly what happened, but there's no doubt I did something wrong," Williams said. "Nelson started screaming at me up and down, wouldn't stop. Finally, Joe," Gibbs, "who was at the other end of the field, just ran in and told him to stop. He kept saying, 'You have to give him time to learn. Don't talk to him like that.' I heard later that the two of them got into it again when the coaches met after practice. From that day on, I went to Joe's house almost every night. I'd have dinner with him and his family, and then we went over the playbook until I had to get back to camp for curfew. By the time we were finished with the sessions, I knew the playbook cold. I'm not sure where my career might have gone if not for him. He and Coach McKay both believed in me and let me know that. I needed that support." He needed it because his life off the field wasn't always easy. He was married with a young child and bought a house in a virtually all-white neighborhood. The neighborhood felt safe. The areas around it, not so much. "When I drove out of the neighborhood toward Dale Mabry Drive to get to I-4, I went past a corner bar," Williams remembered. "One night, two black guys were leaving there with two white women. They were both shot and killed. When the killers were arrested, they said they'd done it because black guys shouldn't be with white women. Tampa was a southern town. I learned that pretty quickly." He often learned it when he went to his mailbox, or more often when the team passed mail on to him. "It wasn't as if there weren't some people pulling for me," he said. "There were. But a lot of the mail was the hate variety. 'Get out of town, you N-word. We don't want you here, N-word.' I opened one envelope, and there was rotting watermelon inside. The note said, 'Try throwing this to your N-word friends. See if they can catch it.'" He smiled. "After a while, I learned if there was no return address on the envelope, I didn't need to open it." Fortunately, he had support from Gibbs and McKay. When I first got to camp, the guys told me you could tell if McKay liked you if he put an IE on the end of your name. A couple weeks in during practice, he said, "Dougie, come over here a minute." After that, it was always Dougie. As long as he called me that, I figured I was okay.